The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The court's language largely said language from the GDPR that made the essential equivalence not be sustained. On the other hand, their finding, they said, was based on the GDPR and the Charter. And so European lawyers that I've talked to since the decision are inclined to think this is a constitutional decision that cannot be overruled by the legislature. That leaves a strictness in place that really puts into question how Europe is going to interact with the rest of the world. I think people are in denial to a certain extent about how strict the court is and how few options there are for Europe to actually do trade with the rest of the world going forward.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 22nd, 2020. Last week, the European Court of Justice released its much-awaited decision in Data Protection Commissioner v. Maximilian Schrems, commonly known as Schrems II, which addressed what privacy requirements governments and corporations within the European Union would be required to secure before participating in international data transfers. The court's decision cast serious doubt on many of the measures currently in place, most notably in relation to the United States' own national security and surveillance activities, and thus raised new questions about how the European Union would continue to interact with the global digital economy. To discuss these developments, I sat down with Peter Swire, professor of law and ethics at the Scheller College of Business at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and himself a former privacy official in the Clinton and Obama administrations, as well as Stuart Baker, who is currently of counsel at Steptoe & Johnson and was previously the Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security during the George W. Bush administration. It's the Lawfare Podcast for July 22nd, Schrems II and the Future of Transatlantic Data. Peter, let me ask you to start us off. Tell us, who is this Maximilian Schrems and what is his beef with the transatlantic relationship?
Well, Max Schrems is once upon a time was an Austrian law student who went to California for a year abroad. And famously, he went to a briefing by Facebook, who essentially said that the Irish protections for European data were run out of an office above a drugstore in Dublin. And the understaffed agency was not effective. And so companies like Facebook really didn't care about those European privacy laws. And so Max was sitting in the back of the audience, according to his story. He came back and he started to challenge Facebook in court over and over again, leading by 2015 to striking down of the US-EU safe harbor. And then after he won that one, he went back to court in Ireland. And last Thursday, Schrems II, as it's called, led to these very strict rulings against data flows to the United States and the rest of the world.
Now, you already mentioned the safe harbor, and of course, another related program, a successor program, Privacy Shield, was one of the major points of issue that's kind of come out of this litigation. Stuart, can you give us a little background before we get into the actual Schrems II decision about what these instruments were and the role that they played in facilitating these sorts of data transfers that are at the essence of this case and could play an important part in transatlantic trade and economic relationships these days?
So it goes back a ways. The original impetus for this is a requirement that has been part of European law since the 90s that says we don't want our European data to go to countries where the legal regime is inadequate, because we fear that while we are regulating these companies with their spam procedures and the like, all they have to do is move the data and then they can legally spam Europeans. And so we're not going to let people send the data to places where they're allowed to do things that they're not allowed to do under European law. And that was originally designed to deal with private entities that were arbitraging the regulatory regimes of two different jurisdictions. That's been part of the law for a long time. More recently, really since 9/11 and the U.S. government's response, which was to start gathering a lot more data and using it for counterterrorism purposes, European negotiators have questioned whether U.S. law with respect to how it handles data in the government is adequate for European purposes. And we've had, I was part of probably three negotiations over how the U.S. government handled travel reservation data. There have been multiple negotiations over other aspects as well. The U.S. government has never adopted a law that says what European law says. So it is by definition inadequate for regulation of the private sector. And the solution that was arrived at by the private sector and I think the Clinton administration was to say, well, how about this? How about companies that want to move data to the United States promise to observe the rules that are part of European law and essentially act as though they were governed by European law while they handle the data in the United States? And that promise, enforceable by U.S. Federal Trade Commission and others, has been the heart of both Privacy Shield and before that, the Safe Harbor. The question was, are the promises enforceable? Do they actually conform to what European law says? And by and large, that has turned out to be the case, but no promise made by a private company can override U.S. law. If U.S. law says you must provide this for counterterrorism purposes. And increasingly, the fight has been over whether the private promises of private companies enforced in the United States are sufficient or whether it is necessary for the U.S. to change the law that it applies when it's dealing with companies for counterterrorism or other intelligence purposes.
So, of course, the decision that came out last week is Schrems 2, is how people are referring to it. But that implies, of course, there's a Schrems 1. Stuart, how does Schrems 1 fit into this framework you kind of laid out for us? And how did it tee up the subsequent decision?
So Schrems 1 and Schrems 2, at the end of the day, I'm not sure there's a big difference. In each case, the European Court of Justice said, we think that the adequacy rules apply to government rules as well as the private sector regulation. And we think that the U.S. government's protections for individual rights are not sufficient. The difference between Schrems 1 and Schrems 2 is the court hinted broadly in Schrems 1 that the Privacy Shield would not survive review. In Schrems 2, the court said, that's right. The Privacy Shield is insufficient because it cannot regulate the actions of the U.S. government. The U.S. government is going to have to adopt rules that look exactly like the European Charter of Fundamental Rights. It hasn't done so. Therefore, nothing may be transferred with respect to in connection with the Privacy Shield.
Could I make a little amendment to what Stuart just said, which is the first case as a legal holding was not about the United States. It was about the quality of the decision made by the European Union Commission. And the court said the commission hadn't done a careful enough job. This time there was a holding for the first time that the United States lacks adequate protection because there's too much surveillance and because there's not enough legal rights protection in the U.S. regime. And going beyond that, this decision went after something that's not about the U.S. It's about the rest of the world outside of Europe. And that's called standard contract clauses. And a very important difference is this is no longer a case about the United States. The European Union now says when exports go to China or to India or to any other country in the world, including the U.S., that there have to be the same legal protections that exist in Europe. And that's same legal protections against government surveillance and law enforcement access. So China seems like clearly illegal under the new decision. Whereas the first decision was about the commission looking at the U.S. system. Now it's partly about the U.S., but it's really about the whole rest of the world.
But I think all of that was implicit in the first decision. What we're seeing is the court is absolutely determined to impose its view of what individual rights require when personal data is processed by governments on the entire world. As I described it in a post that's going up on Lawfare, it's gobsmacking in what you might describe as its combination of judicial imperialism and solipsism. It really believes that the sun rises and sets on Brussels.
Well, that raises another issue, which I want to interject here, and that's the question of what the posture the court took in this case was. Peter, in your write-up on the decision that was up on Lawfare a few days ago, you know that it really adopted a much stricter and more demanding view of the law in the space, and one that departs a little bit from maybe some more subtle frameworks that we've seen the European Court of Human Rights and even different constitutional courts in Europe take in approaching these questions of extraterritoriality and around privacy. Walk us through that a little bit. What were the options kind of on the table for the court, and why did it choose this one, and what does it mean that it did choose this one?
Right. Well, the European Court of Justice, the court in Luxembourg, has particular jurisdiction. So, for instance, national security by the member states is outside of its competence. And that means the European Court of Justice doesn't go and assess Germany's intelligence regime or France's intelligence regime or Romania's. And then another thing they could have looked to is the long jurisprudence that the European Court of Human Rights has done from the Strasbourg Court, where there were two important recent decisions that said, well, maybe you can actually do surveillance to protect your country, but you ought to have a fairly reasonable, by comparison, set of safeguards in place. The Schrems II decision said, we're not going to look at what the member states do. That's not our job. So even though they don't live up to what the U.S. does, we don't care. It also said, we're not going to look to what the Strasbourg Court said, which has some nuance and some understanding that you're supposed to have national security in a dangerous world. Instead, we are going to invent under the Charter for the European Union, basically the constitution created by the EU about 10 years ago, we're going to invent a jurisprudence and we're the sole people who get to decide that jurisprudence. And the rest of the world's just going to have to live with it because we are writing the rules and the rules are super duper strict.
One concept that plays a central role, particularly in evaluating the comparison between EU standards and American standards in this case, although presumably other jurisdictions as well, is this idea of equivalency. But what are the hallmarks of equivalency that the court is looking at? What is it looking at? Is it about process? Is it about substantive standards? Is it about separate independent decision making? And how does that weigh into the different ways that jurisdictions might approach these privacy questions in ways similar or different to how the EU does? Stuart, let me start with you with that one.
Yeah. So essentially equivalent, really, first, it is a gloss that the court put on this. It is present in one of the introductory clauses to the to GDPR, but it's an off ramp not taken. The court could have said, "Look, democracies have different views about exactly how to protect the essentials of their democratic process and their individual rights, and we recognize that. And as long as you are in the neighborhood, you're doing the kinds of things that you expect a democratic government to do, we're going to hold that as sufficient. They did not do that. They said, no, it really has to look like the words of that we are about to put forward. And then they extracted from the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union a set of procedures that are or requirements that are both substantive and procedural. There has to be an opportunity to be heard and to have to seek redress if you believe that your rights have been infringed. There has to be proportionality and a justification written into the statute for the kinds of intrusions on the private sphere that are being carried out in the name of the state. So there's a variety of restrictions, some of them quite familiar to, I think, the European Court of Human Rights, and others a little more strict, because the European Court of Justice, to my mind, has been remarkably ideologically determined to find fault with the United States in ways that I think raise questions about their motivation. They, in TREMS 1, for example, the court was so eager to find fault with U.S. procedures that it didn't bother to seek a fact-finding hearing. They instead took the facts from The Guardian, and The Guardian had gotten them wrong. Those facts are still part of the record in TREMS 1 as the justification for the conclusion that they reached. So I think Peter is quite right that they are more determined than any court in the world to impose these rules. And I actually think they're stuck with the rest of the world. It's the United States that they're shooting at.
Well, now you mentioned four letters that have come to play a prominent role in these questions about privacy rules, particularly in the transatlantic relationship, but really apply much broader. And that's, of course, GDPR, which stands for the Global Data Protection Regulation. Peter, let me ask you, how does the GDPR fit into this broader picture? And what are the implications that SREMS 2 has for its implementation, for its application, and vice versa?
So Europe began its Europe-wide privacy rules in 1998 with what they called the directive, and they did a big overhaul and harmonized it into what they called the General Data Protection Regulation. That went into effect early in 2018. In many ways, the rules are the same when it comes to transferring data out of Europe. You have possibly adequate jurisdictions you send it to, or if it's not adequate, people have used things like what are called standard contract clauses to protect the data when it leaves Europe. There's a couple of things about GDPR that are special. One is that the fines are very big. So now if a company violates GDPR, its maximum fine is 4% of its global revenue. So before, under the directive, if a company was punished, it might pay 100,000 euros. Now it's paying 4% of its global revenues and under an injunction to stop transferring the data. So that could be continued, presumably. So what was an aspirational set of laws in some instances for privacy now is subject to this heavy-handed enforcement. So that's one huge change with GDPR. The other question is how much this new decision is based on GDPR and how much of it is constitutional based on the charter that was created by the Treaty of Lisbon. So the court's language largely said language from the GDPR that made the essential equivalence not be sustained. On the other hand, their finding, they said, was based on the GDPR and the charter. And so European lawyers that I've talked to since the decision are inclined to think this is a constitutional decision that cannot be overruled by the legislature. That leaves a strictness in place that really puts into question how Europe is going to interact with the rest of the world. I think people are in denial to a certain extent about how strict the court is and how few options there are for Europe to actually do trade with the rest of the world going forward.
I think that's an excellent point. The European Commission, which drove this for 20 years, used the adequacy provisions as a way to, in the European Union way, get in the path of the United States and interfere with what the United States wanted to do sufficiently to force negotiations so that they could become a true partner or participant in whatever legal development they were participating in. But they never pushed it to the point of a rupture. When I was doing one of these negotiations, I actually believed that they didn't have the nerve to push it to rupture and drove one of the negotiations off the cliff to the point where the Europeans actually had to start assessing fines against airlines that complied with U.S. law. And of course, they didn't. And they started quickly abandoning some of their negotiating positions. Now they don't have that flexibility. The court has locked up the exits for the commission, with one possible exception that we can talk about later.
That leads well into the next question I want to ask, and that is the next steps after this decision for the actors involved in various parts. And of course, there is the bilateral part of that about, you know, the United States and EU governments and other governments. But before that, let's start with the actual companies involved that are relying upon these agreements that now, whose validity may now be in question. What is the legal process that they are facing after this in terms of enforcement, follow-on actions, and the real threat of sanctions that Stuart noted before that obviously comes with this sort of decision? What do we look at to see how those actual policies are being implemented down the road, and how likely is that to affect the actual outcome and impact on these companies?
So the court decision says what happens next, which is each company, before it exports data, personal data from Europe, is supposed to assess whether there's sufficient safeguards in place. For instance, will the NSA look at the communications? And then the data protection authority in each country is supposed to then be also looking at exports to each country and has responsibility to stop those exports if they're not being done properly. So that's quite a strict regime. How will it get sorted out? The court declares that the European Data Protection Board, which is the agency where all the different national privacy regulators come together, is supposed to resolve any disagreements among the data protection authorities. And so at a practical level, major companies are looking to guidance from the European Data Protection Board in the coming weeks and months to say what's okay and what's not okay. But if the Data Protection Board is loose about what it does, which has not been its usual practice, but even if it is permissive, we would then see more challenges from probably the same litigants. And the court doesn't seem to leave as much room as almost any practical path would really require.
I agree with that. What we're seeing is that there are fewer and fewer options. The court has been closing off options and signaling that there is not really an option in which you can use the corporate clauses to solve your problem of moving data out of Europe, because, of course, everybody knows corporate clauses cannot govern the behavior of the government that has jurisdiction. And so my guess is that the process of trying to justify use of the standard clauses will buy people a few months or a year or two, but the litigation is coming, which will make it really not an option, at which point the companies will really face, I think, an almost unimaginably difficult choice. I'm thinking about how telecommunications firms can handle this. The court is hostile to an NSA program that looks at data upstream from the actual users. It's essentially the backbone of the internet. And if that hostility is carried through, as it seems likely, it raises the question whether any internet provider can route any information through the United States. And I doubt they can deliver without routing it through the United States. So this has enormously disruptive consequences. To my mind, the U.S. reaction to this should be to heighten the contradictions, not to try to solve the problem. we are at a point where the court has finally gone so far that no one thinks their approach is a sensible one. And the rest of the world can see the handwriting on the wall. The Canadians have already had programs attacked. India and Australia have been in the waiting room for a decade trying to figure out how to meet the requirements that continue to increase under the court's rulings. The rest of the, China just isn't having it. And yet it will be very easy to bring a Schrems case against Chinese data flows. And that means a massive trade war between Europe and China and probably the remaining countries that are dealing with the problems of adequacy.
Well, then let's go to the kind of bilateral or multilateral side of this in terms of the next step. So, Stuart, you said briefly that you'd like to see the United States exaggerate or expand the kind of tensions between the European system, presumably in an effort to impose costs upon European consumers that would then register in the political system and result in a change of policy. Can you outline that in a little more detail? And then Peter, after that, I'd like to turn to you and get your reaction and then also see what next steps you might see on the horizon for the United States and for other governments affected by this.
I think one of the problems is that for 20 years, we've managed to kind of fudge the issue, and Europeans don't believe that the United States is going to do anything other than eventually concede that they have the moral high ground. And the U.S. has, for a variety of reasons, not felt angry enough about this to turn it into a real crisis. But I think we are at the point where only a crisis will resolve this. What the court has instructed the rest of the European government to do is almost certainly a violation of our Europe's WTO obligations, which only allows them to impose restrictions on data flows for privacy reasons that are neither arbitrary nor discriminatory. And when they allow data flows to member states who are not required to meet these requirements, and to China, which has never been required to meet these requirements, they're clearly engaged in an arbitrary and discriminatory activity. The U.S. government has authority in the executive branch to impose import restrictions and tariffs for violations of the WTO obligations. They could start now to say, who do we have to get the attention of to persuade the Europeans that they have to find a way out of this mess? And I would submit that Germany is the logical candidate, and German automobiles, which ironically probably sent a lot of data back to Germany, are a good place to start with very large, maybe 4% of global gross income tariffs on imports into the United States, just to make it absolutely clear that this is going to have to be negotiated, that the U.S. is not going to change its very valuable intelligence programs to meet the theoretical and dangerously unrealistic expectations of the European court.
Let me point out that there was one important, you might call it victory out of all this, which is China and the rest of the world are now on the hook, and this is not bilateral. There was a big risk in the litigation, and I was an expert witness in the Irish hearings for this case and wrote extensively about this. There was a big risk that the U.S. would be found inadequate, but they would forget to mention China's incredible inadequacy when it comes to government surveillance. And instead, the court issued language around these contract clauses that puts China and the rest of the world in the spot as well. And so the U.S. has very comprehensive rule of law protections around intelligence, but that doesn't matter anymore because so much of the rest of the world doesn't. And so the message somehow got through. It was argued at oral argument. It was a good thing. The court now has basically ruled Russia and China and other countries off the table. And so there's an opportunity to show consequences and an opportunity to get allies with the United States, because it's not just a U.S. issue anymore. And for the privacy people who work on this stuff, they're so used to thinking of it as a bilateral EU and U.S. thing. And now that won't be the case. And so Stewart is breaking open the idea of what are the alliances, what are the ways to create a crisis. A few days in, Brussels is not in crisis, except a few days in, the experts in Brussels realize they don't have a path forward and they don't know what to do. And they're probably going to need to come under pressure to do uncomfortable things. And if they don't, the answer is clear. There'll be massive data localization in Europe. Lots and lots of trade between Europe and the United States will no longer be legal. And Europe will have chosen that. But that's a big consequence that hasn't been made by the democracies in Europe or by the leaders in Europe. And this is a much harder problem than most of the privacy people want to admit it is.
I think that's the sunniest of scenarios. I think the Chinese government is going to be as angry about this interference in how they discipline their populations as one could imagine. And they're not simply going to say to their companies, oh, yeah, just localize the data, no problem. They're going to insist that the data come back because in many cases, that's data about their overseas nationals or the overseas community that they think of as natural allies. And they want to know what those folks are doing. So I don't think they're going to accept it. And they know how to squeeze German car companies even better than we do. So this is going to turn into a disaster for Europe. And maybe a disaster for Europe before it turns into a disaster for the U.S. companies that initially triggered this.
And an initial step is to have enforcement actions in Europe against China. That's where the attention should be because their practices are indefensible, and that will change how it looks to have data flows to the U.S.
So one of the things that I would like to focus on is what are the solutions that we could be negotiating toward? And while I agree that the court tried to put this on the basis of a constitutional requirement, their constitution is at bottom just a treaty. It's a treaty that created the European Union. It is the foundational treaty, but it is a treaty. And in that treaty, they said, we're going to have a charter. And now they have a charter. And the charter is fundamental rights. But under international law, the next treaty you sign can modify the last treaty you signed. And so if we simply took the Privacy Shield Agreement and said, you know, that was a formal international law. That was a treaty. And the United States made a bunch of binding promises. We neglected to ask Europe for a binding promise that they would allow data flows if this was observed. Now we're going to go back to the negotiating table and you will give us that assurance. And that assurance will override the treaty and the charter.
Brussels hasn't even begun to believe that might happen, but they, I think, are in denial. And even the experts know they can try to buy time, but they're in denial in a major way over there.
Yeah.
So Stewart, you know, for the set of issues you've laid out one sort of fairly aggressive tack the United States could take, but what other solutions might be on the table that might fall short of that the United States may be able to pursue in the short term, at least?
I would take advantage of the fact that the court said, oh, by the way, we have nothing to say about the national security decisions and structures of the member states. They do what they want under European law for national security purposes, and say, let's find somebody who is sympathetic to the United States who will say, yeah, as an exercise of my national security powers, I am going to allow exports of data to the United States from my territory. And in exchange, I'll get a bunch of national security assistance from the United States in the form of intelligence sharing. And I am using solely my national security powers for this purpose. And if you just move your data, as you're allowed to in the single market, to, say, Poland or Hungary or maybe even Ireland, you can export it from there without having to worry about a penalty because we're allowing it under our national security authority. Or alternatively, they could say, if you think that's a little excessive, they could say, all right, we've talked to our data protection authority, and the data protection authority has agreed that if you export it from our territory, when somebody brings an action against the data exporter, they will have to show actual economic harm to recover or succeed in their lawsuit against the data transfer. And since nobody's yet found anything other than theoretical harms, you could sustain that for a long time. Eventually, my guess is the court would catch up with you. But if you're looking for a three-year solution that will require yet more litigation before anybody is at risk, I think there's a possibility there.
So, Peter, let me turn to you with a kind of closing question. Stuart's put forward some interesting ideas about ways you might be able to, at least in the short term, work around this from a litigation perspective, leverage the limited jurisdiction of the court, leverage the limited role of treaties versus more constitutional arrangements. But we also know that there have been, at least in the treaty realm, at least some limits to this. We know about the CADI decisions, which treats EU fundamental international agreements with a little bit more of a constitutional character than maybe you might associate with regular international treaties. Different contexts, but we could see those principles applied here. Do you think that there is, in the perhaps the medium to long term, a legal fix, a litigation fix to this? Or is it something that fundamentally requires a kind of reevaluation of the underlying policies, meaning something more like a democratic fix, a policy change from the political branches of either the EU or I suppose the United States and other countries as well?
So in the short to medium term, there are various ways to try to buy time. But if the court continues the way it seems like it's continuing, you get basically two choices 3 years from now. One of them would be that there really is massive data localization and Europe cuts itself off from many data flows. And that would be constitutional and legal in Europe, but it would have these big effects. The other, it has to do something fundamental. Stuart said, make a change to the Treaty of Lisbon. I've proposed change Article 46 of the GDPR to go back to what we always thought the rules were, which is you don't have to assess government surveillance outside of Europe. But unless you get that kind of fundamental change, once we're done buying time, the rules announced by the court don't leave other choices. People wish they would, and maybe legal fictions can survive for a while, but the court has now backed Europe into a corner, and there's no easy way out of it.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it there for today. Peter and Stuart, thank you so much for joining us on the Lawfare podcast.
My pleasure.
Pleasure being here.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. This podcast was engineered by Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Patcha Howell. And our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.